outcasts had never seen, as he pulled at the raw silk belt and the gown fell open. Broken street light across the curves within. The feel of her breast, as he laid one hand on it, was burned into his palm, the soft sound of the laugh in her throat. Highgate. Involuntarily he opened the hand at the memory, looked at it, as if for some sign of branding. I can't do this, Liz, he'd lied. I'm sorry. And he turned away to stare out the window, pretty sure this was the only way to stop the landslide, trembling with the force of it. Fair enough, she told him, and in the window he watched her bend to leave the glass on the table by the futon. She stood for a moment at the door before she left, looking at his back, but she said nothing. She had not retied the gown. The gap between its edges was black in the reflected image, empty of detail that his own mind was feverishly happy to fill. In the morning, he woke to find the gown draped across the quilt he had slept under. At some point during the night she had come in, taken it off, and stood naked watching him sleep. Even through the layers of mild hangover, it was an intensely erotic image, and he felt himself hardening at the thought. The house was silent around him. Birdsong from the tree outside the window, a solitary car engine somewhere distant. He lay propped up on one elbow in the bed, vague with last night's drinking. Without conscious thought he reached for the gown, dragged it up the bed and held it to his face. It smelled intimately of woman, the only woman's scent outside of Carla's that he had breathed in nearly a decade. The shock was visceral, dissolving the hangover and dumping him out into reality like an exasperated bouncer. He threw off the gown and the quilt in a single motion, threw on clothes. Watch and wallet. Off the bedside table in a sweep, stamping into shoes, he slid out of the spare room and paused. There was no one home. It was a feeling he knew well, and the house echoed with it. A handwritten note lay on the kitchen table detailing where breakfast things could be found, the number of a good cab company, and how to set the alarms before leaving. It was signed, "Stay in Touch." He got out. No appetite for breakfast. No confidence that he wouldn't do something really stupid like go through her things, or, worse still, wait around for her to come back. He triggered the alarm set up, and the door closed him out on a rising whine as the house defenses charged. He found himself on a tree-lined hill street that swept up behind him, and then down, then up again in front. A couple of prestige cars and a four-track were parked at intervals along the curbs. Down near the base of the parabola, the street described, someone was walking a German shepherd. There was no one else about. It looked like a nice neighborhood. He didn't know Highgate. Had been in the area only a couple of times before in his life, to drink and drug-blurred parties at the homes of HM execs, but the air was mild and the sky looked clear of rain in all directions. He chose the downslope at random and started walking. The Saab jolted a badly mended pothole, dumped him back into reality. The memory of Highgate dropped away, receding in the rear view. Carla. He reached across the space between them. He touched her cheek with the back of his fingers. Look, I'm sorry. I didn't mean anything about your mother. It was a joke, all right. Ha, fucking ha. He held down the quick flare of anger. Carla, we've got to stop this. We've only been in each other's company half an hour, and we're fighting already. This is killing us. You're the one who— She stopped, and he wondered what she was biting back, the way he'd bitten back words a few moments earlier. Is this it? He wondered dismally. Is this the only way to survive a long-term relationship? Hide your thoughts, bite back your feelings, build a neutral silence that won't hurt. Is that what it's all about? Neutrality for the sake of a warm bed? Is that what I turned Liz down for? Liz, waiting, wrapped in the white silk that carried her scent. Carla, pull over.
What?
Pull over, stop, there on the hard shoulder, please. She shot him a look and must have seen something in his face. The Saab bled speed and drifted across the lanes. Carla dropped a gear and brought the car down under 100 kilometers an hour. Onto the hard shoulder, and they crunched to a halt. Carla turned in her seat to face him.
All right?
Carla, listen. He put his hands on her shoulders, feeling his way toward what he needed to say. Please don't run off like that again. Like you did. I missed you. I really did. I need you. And when you're not here, I miss you so much. I do stupid things. Her eyes widened.
Things like what?
And he could not fucking tell her. He couldn't. He thought he was going to. He even started to, started with Troy Morris's party, even got as far as talking about Liz with her book proposal, but he couldn't do it. And when she knew there was more behind it and pushed for it, he veered off into the zones and what he and Mike Bryant had done to Griff Dixon and his friends. She whitened as he told it.
That can't be, she whispered. You... they can't...
scaling almost to a shout.
People can't do things like that. It's not legal.
Tell that to Mike. Ah, oh, Christ, tell it to the whole fucking Shawn Corporation while you're at it. And then it all had to come tumbling out. The morning after. The name contract. The fuck-up with Lopez and Langley. The dead in Medellin. And the quick-fix burial of the facts. Panama and Barranco and his quiet insistence. You do not belong. Chris found he was trembling by the time he got to the end, and there was what felt like a laugh building in his throat, but when it finally came out his eyes were wet. He unfastened his belt and leaned across the space between the seats. He pulled himself across and against her, teeth gritted on the fraying shreds of his control. They clung together.
Chris...
There was something in Carla's voice that might have been a laugh as well, and what she was saying made no kind of sense. But the way she held him, that didn't seem to matter much.
Chris, listen to me. It's okay. There's a way out of this.
She started to lay it out for him. Less than a minute in, he was shouting her down.
You can't be fucking serious, Carla. That's not a way out. Chris, please listen to me. A fucking ombudsman? What do you think I am, a socialist, a fucking loser? Those people are...
He gestured at the enormity of it, groping for words. Carla folded her arms and looked at him.
A what? Dangerous? Do you want to tell me again how you murdered 3 unarmed men in the zones last weekend? They were scum, Carla, armed or not. And the carjackers, back in January, were they scum too?
That...
And the people in that cafe in Medellin?
Her voice was rising again.
The people you killed in the Cambodia playoff. Isaac Murchison, who you dreamed about every night for a year after you killed him. And now you have the insane fucking nerve to tell me the ombudsmen are dangerous?
He raised his hands.
I didn't say that. You were going to?
You don't know what I was going to say. He lied. I was going to say those people are—they're losers, Carla. They're standing against the whole tide of globalization, of progress, for fuck's sake.
Is it progress?
She asked, suddenly quiet.
Balkanization and slaughter abroad, and a free market feeding off the bones, a poverty-line economy and gladiatorial contests on the roads at home. Is that supposed to be progress?
That's your father talking.
No, fuck you, Chris. This is me talking. You think I don't have opinions of my own? You think I can't look around and see for myself what's happening? You think I'm not living out the consequences?
You don't?
You know, in Norway, when I tell people where I live, where I choose to live, they look at me like I'm some kind of moral retard. When I tell them what my husband does for a living, they...
Oh, here we go. He turned away from her in the narrow confines of the car. Outside his window, the wind whipped along the embankment, flattening the long grass. Here we fucking go again.
Chris, listen to me.
A hand on his shoulder, he shrugged it off angrily.
Chris, you've got to stand outside it for a moment. That's what I did while I was in Tromsø. You've got to see it from the outside to understand. You're a paid killer, Chris. A paid killer, a dictator in all but name.
Oh, for...
Echevarria, right? You told me about Echevarria.
What about him?
You talk as if you hate him, as if he's a monster."
"He pretty much is, Carla."
"And what's the difference between the two of you, Chris? Every atrocity he commits, you underwrite. You told me about the torture, the people in those police cells, and the bodies on the garbage dumps. You put those people there, Chris. You may as well have been there with the electrodes."
"That's not fair. Echevarria isn't mine."
"Isn't yours?"
"It isn't my account, Carla. I don't get to make the decisions on that one. In fact..."
"Oh, and Cambodia's different? You get to make the decisions on that one because you told me you do, and I read the reports while I was away, Chris. The Independent Press, for a change. They say this Kyusari is going to be as bad as the original Khmer Rouge."
"That's bullshit. Q's a pragmatist. He's a good bet, and even if he gets out of hand, we can..."
"Out of hand? What does that mean, Chris, out of hand?
You mean if the body count gets into the tens of thousands? If they run out of places to bury them secretly?
Chris, for fuck's sake, listen to yourself."
He turned back. "I didn't make the world the way it is, Carla. I'm just trying to live in it."
"We don't have to live in it this way."
"No? You want to live in the fucking zones, do you?" He reached across and grabbed at the leather jacket she was wearing. "You think they wear this kind of stuff in the zones? You think they get to jet off to Scandinavia when you fucking feel like it if you live in the zones?"
"I'm not..."
"You want to be an old woman at 40? She flinched at the lash in his voice. He was losing control now, tears stinging in his eyes. "Is that what you want, Carla? Obese from the shit they stuff the food with? Diabetic from the fucking sugar content? Allergies from the additives? No money for decent medical treatment? Is that what you want? You want to die poor? Die because you're poor? Is that what you fucking want, Carla? Because..." The slap turned his head. Jarred loose the tears from his eyelids, he blinked and tasted blood.
"Now you listen to me," she said evenly. "You shut up and hear what I have to say, or this is over. I mean it, Chris."
"You have no idea," he muttered.
"Don't try to pull rank on me, Chris. My father lives in the zones."
"Your father?" Derisively, voice rising again. "Your father doesn't..."
"I'm warning you, Chris."
He looked away, cranked down the anger. "Your father," he said quietly, "is a tourist. He has no children, no dependents, nothing that ties him where he is, nothing to force him. He isn't like the people he surrounds himself with, and he never will be. He could be gone tomorrow if he chose to, and that's what makes the difference."
"He thinks he can make a difference."
"And can he?" Silence. Finally, he looked back at her. "Can he, Carla?" He reached out and took her hand. "Yesterday, I was on the other side of the world, talking to a man who might be able to kick Echevarria out of the ME. If I get my way, it'll happen. Isn't that worth something? Isn't that something better than the articles your father hammers out for readers who'll shake their heads and act shocked and never lift a fucking finger to change anything?"
"If it matters to you so much to change things all of a sudden, why can't you..."
The heavy throb of rotors overhead. The car rocked on its suspension. The radio crackled to life. "Driver control. This is driver control." The rotor noise grew, even through the Saab's soundproofing. The helicopter's belly dropped into view, black and luminous green, showing landing skids, underslung cameras and gatlings. It skidded back a few meters as if nervous of the stopped car. The voice splashed out of the radio again. "Owner of Saab Custom Registration S810576, please identify yourself." "What the fuck for, dickhead?" The thought was a random jag of anger. "Match me from the footage you've just shot through my windshield, why don't you, instead of wasting my motherfucking time?" "This is a security requirement," admonished the voice. "This is Chris Faulkner," he said heavily. "Driver clearance 260B354R. "I work for Shawn Associates. Now fuck off, will you? My wife's not feeling well and you're not helping." There was a brief silence while the numbers ran. The voice came back, diffident. "Sorry to trouble you, sir. It's just stopping like that on the motorway. If your wife needs hospitalization, we can...
I said, fuck off.
The helicopter dithered for a moment longer, then spun about and lifted out of view. They sat for a while, listening to its departing chunter.
Nice to know they're watching, Carla said bitterly.
Yeah. He closed his eyes. She touched his arm.
Chris?
All right. He nodded, opened his eyes. All right. I'll talk to them. File number 3. Foreign Aid. Chapter 25. 2 weeks. For Chris, marooned on the fringes of the preparations, it passed like a waking dream. He lived a distorted copy of his real life, tinged in equal portions by nightmarish tension and an odd, unlooked-for romantic nostalgia. Work was as he'd expected. He acted normal and watched his back. Troop movements in Assam, hostage-taking in Paraná, and in Cambodia, a handful of executions no one had foreseen. He handled it all with eerie calm. At home he dared not talk openly to Carla, so they took up a bizarre dual existence, life in the house as if nothing had changed, set against hushed exchanges snatched in the secure confines of the Saab. Carla, somehow, had persuaded Eric and Kirsty to act together as the link with the Ombudsman, and she went regularly to the Brundtland to gather details from her father. Some kind of code was in use over Eric's netlink, a fake reconciliation underway between the parents to serve as cover for the information Chris and Carla agreed on in their hasty conferences in the car. And here came the nostalgia. The bittersweet taste of something almost used up. The moments grabbed in the Saab had the tang of illicit sexual encounters, and once or twice even ended that way. And the rest of the time, acting out normality for any possible listeners, they treated each other with an abnormal tenderness and consideration. In both aspects of their new existence, they were getting on better than they had in months. It was weird. 2 weeks, and the Ombudsman came. He disliked Truls Vasvik on sight. Partly it was the Norwegian thing, the same irritating aura of easy outdoor competence that he'd noticed in most of Carla's friends on the few occasions they'd been up in Tromsø together. But more than that, it was the clothes. Here was a trained professional who, Carla claimed, earned at least the same as he did, and Chris could have bought the man's entire outfit for less than he usually spent on a haircut. The grey wool of the jersey was stretched and pilled, the nondescript trousers were bagged in the knees, and the walking boots had shaped themselves to Vasvik's feet with constant use. The coat looked as if he'd slept in it. It only needed the carelessly tied back greying hair to complete the image of a teen anti-globalist who'd never grown up. Which is exactly what he is. "Thanks for coming," he said guardedly. Vasvik shrugged. "I should thank you. You are taking a far greater risk than I." "Really?" Chris tried to ignore the jolt Vasvik's comment delivered to his stomach. The setup had left him jangled and twitchy. A shrill part of him wondered if the Ombudsman was trying to psych him out. "I would have thought we'd both be arrested pretty fucking rapidly." "Yes, we would. But your government would be forced to release me intact. That much power we still have. The police might work me over a little while they have me, but it's unlikely to be worse than some other close encounters I've had." "Hard man, huh?" Another shrug.
Vasvik looked around the workshop and spotted an ancient steel bar stool shoved against one wall. He went to fetch it. Chris mastered his irritation and waited for the Norwegian to come back. Again, he couldn't be sure if Vasvik was doing it deliberately or not. The Ombudsman's detached calm was impenetrable. Out in the rest of Mel's autofix, tools whined and screeched. The noise raked along his nerves. It hadn't been easy, finding a safe place to meet, and even now he wondered how far he could trust Carla's boss. "Well," Vasvik dragged the stool under the jacked Audi Mel had left on the lift, and seated himself. "Shall we talk about extraction?"
"In a minute." Chris prowled the space beneath the Audi.
Extraction.
The way the word hung there was another jolt in itself, like walking up to Louise Hewitt at the Quarterly and asking her out loud if she wanted to fuck. I'm still getting used to this. Maybe I still need to be convinced. Then we're wasting each other's time. I'm not here to talk you into something, Faulkner. We can live without you at Unect. Chris stared at him. Carla said, Carla Nyquist cares about you. I do not. Personally, Faulkner, I don't give a shit what happens to you. I think you're scum. The ethical commerce guys would like to hear what you have. That's why I'm here. But I'm not a salesman. I don't have to reel you in to get my name up on some commission board somewhere. And frankly, I have a lot of better things to do with my time. You come in or you don't. Your choice. But don't waste my time. Chris flushed. I'm told, he said evenly, that Unect recruits people, scum, like me, for the Ombudsman. That's important, because I need a job. Now. Have I been misinformed? No, that's correct. So we could end up colleagues. Vasvik looked at him coldly. It takes all sorts. Must be hard, Chris taunted, working alongside people that disgust you, putting up with such a low grade of humanity. It's good preparation for undercover work, living with this stink. The workshop Mel had lent them had been swept for bugs an hour ago, and there was too much metalwork going on in the other shops for exterior scanning to be possible. Still, there seemed to be an audience waiting, as the pause smoked off Vasvik's words. Chris felt his fists curling. Do you have any idea, he said, who the fuck you're talking to? The other man's grin was a baring of teeth, a challenge. Why don't you enlighten me? I have treated you with respect. You've got no fucking choice, Faulkner. I'm your escape hatch. You want out so bad I can smell it on you. Your shriveled little soul has finally gotten tired of what you do for a living, and now you're looking for redemption with no drop in salary. I'm your only hope. I doubt you earn what I'm used to. Doubt away. Oh, yeah? Blow it all on clothes, do you? Chris stabbed a finger at the Norwegian. I know your sort, Vasvik. You grew up in your cozy little Scandinavian nanny state, and when you found out the rest of the world couldn't afford the same propped-up, artificial playgroup economic standards, you never got over it. Now you're out there sulking and throwing moral tantrums because the world won't behave the way you want it to. Vasvik examined the palm of one hand. Yeah, but on the other hand, I didn't watch my mother die of a curable illness, and... Hey! Then go to work for the people who made it happen. It was like a lightning strike. The slow-burning anger sheeted to split-second fury, and Chris was in motion. Attack raged at the edges of his control. A Shotokan punch to the temple that would have killed Vasvik had it landed. Somehow the Ombudsman was not there. The stool staggered in the air, tumbled sideways. Vasvik was a whirl of black coat and reaching hands off to one side. Chris felt his wrist brushed, turned in some subtle way, and then he was hurled across the workshop on the wings of his own momentum. He crashed into the bench, hands trying to brace, a sound behind him and something hooked his legs out from under him at the ankle. His face smashed the bench surface among scattering drill bits and bolts. Something sharp gouged his cheek in passing. He felt Vasvik's weight on him and tried to kick. The Norwegian locked up his arm to the nape of his neck, grabbed his head by the hair, and rammed it back down on the bench, sideways. "Mistake," he gritted in Chris's ear. "Now, are you going to behave, or am I going to break your fucking arm?" Chris heaved up once against the weight, but it was useless. He slumped. Vasvik let go suddenly and was gone. Somewhere behind him, Chris heard the Ombudsman picking up the stool. When he got himself upright and turned, Vasvik was seated again. There was a faint beading of sweat across the palm forehead, but otherwise the fight might never have happened. "My mistake," he said quietly, not looking at Chris. "I shouldn't have let you get to me like that. In a Cambodian enterprise zone, that kind of giveaway'd get me a bullet in the back of the head." Chris stood there, blinking tears. Vasvik sighed heavily. His voice was dull and weary. As an operational ombudsman, you'll earn approximately €180,000 a year, adjusted. That includes a hazardous duties bonus, which you can reckon on getting for about 60% of the work you do. Undercover assignments, swoop raids, witness protection. The rest of the time they keep you on backroom stuff. Admin and forward planning, that's so you don't burn out. Another deep breath. Housing and schools for your kids are free. Accommodation and expenses while on assignment, you claim. I'm sorry for that crack about your mother. You didn't deserve that. Chris coughed a laugh.
Told you I made more than you.
Yeah, well, fuck you, then. Vasvik's voice never lifted from the tired monotone. His gaze never shifted from the corner of the workshop.
Do you like it?
Chris asked him finally. The ombudsman looked at him.
It matters,
he said, pausing on each word as if English were suddenly difficult for him.
You're doing something that matters. I don't expect you to understand that. It sounds like a bad joke, just saying it, but it means something.
They faced each other for a while. Then Chris reached into his jacket and pulled out a plastic-sheathed disc. This is a breakdown of the accounts I service for Sean. There's nothing here you can use, but anyone who knows the ground will be able to work out what I know. Take it back and ask them if I'm worth extracting. I want the package you just talked about, plus $1 million or euro equivalent payout on extraction. He saw the look on Vasvik's face. He heard his own voice harden.
It's not negotiable. I'm losing heavily if I pull out now. I'm plugged in here. Comfortable, stock options, executive benefits, the house, industry rep, client connections. All of that's worth something to me. You want me? You've got to make it worth my while.
He tossed the disc across. Vasvik caught it and examined it curiously. He looked back up at Chris.
And if we don't want you that badly?
Chris shrugged.
Then I'll stay here.
Yeah? You sure you've still got the stomach for that?
I'm not like you, Vasvik.
Chris wiped at the gouge in his cheek, and his fingers came away specked with blood.
I've got the stomach for whatever they can feed me.
Vasvik left in the back of a covered truck, supplied by Mel, and on its way to Paris for Renault parts. Jess drove, no shotgun rider along. U-necked operatives would vanish the ombudsman at the other end. No questions. Carla had sold the whole thing to Mel as wrangling over preferential supply contracts, a new covert bid from Volvo coming in to upset the BMW status quo at Sean. Both Mel and Jess hated BMWs with a deep and abiding passion, and as far as they were concerned, anything that might reduce the number of them on the streets of London just had to be a good thing, dear, just had to be. Carla came in a couple of minutes later, a welding mask still pushed up on her head. Chris was trying to assess the damage to his face in a propped-up fragment of mirror he'd found on the floor.
"What did you say to him?"
she asked angrily. Chris pressed at his cheek, peering at the gouge in the mirror shard.
"I told him our terms, and I gave him the disc.
Went like swimming."
"You had a fight, didn't you?"
"We had a minor disagreement."
He gave up on the mirror and turned to face her.
"I said some things I shouldn't have. Then he said something he really shouldn't have. Took a while to straighten out."
"He's trying to help you, Chris."
"No."
He couldn't keep the snap out of his voice. "He's looking for benefits, Carla. Just like every other fucker in this world. Quid pro fucking quo." She stared at him, wordless for a moment, then turned away and walked out of the workshop. He let her go. Chapter 26. It rained hard most of the next week, and the roads turned treacherous. As usual, patchwork repairs hadn't stood up to the summer weather, and the various service providers were still squabbling about whose responsibility it was to put it right. Chris drove the Saab at careful velocities, getting into Sean later than usual and doing a lot of his phone work from the car. The data down ran remote scrambling and patched through flagged callers on automatic. Back to work. Back to the pretense. It was easier now he was committed. 2 weeks of jittering uncertainty, of not knowing if they'd get away with it, knowing even less what would come of the meeting, now it all gave way to solid data. He knew they wanted him now. knew at a level he could trust more than Carla's wishful-thinking assurances and his own mixed feelings. Now it was just a matter of waiting to see if they could afford him. A no-lose situation. They could afford him, he went. They couldn't afford him, he stayed. Either way, he had work. He had guarantees. He had income. A small part of him knew that he would lose Carla if he stayed. But somehow he couldn't make that matter as much as he knew it should. Back to work. Wednesday morning, turning onto the Elsinum ramp, he heard from Lopez, confirmation of Vicente Barranco's arrival date.
"It's good,"
said the America's agent, through the crackle of the scrambler and a bad satellite link.
"The way I figure it, you've got North on. You could show him around, maybe buy him a few assault rifles."
"Yeah, that's..."
"Fuck!"
His foot came off the accelerator as the realization hit. He nearly braked.
"Chris?"
Lopez sounded concerned.
"You still there?"
He sighed. The car picked up speed again down the ramp. "Yeah, I'm still here. I don't suppose there's any way you could set that date back about a week."
"A week? Jesus, Chris, you said as soon as possible. You said you'd move things around to..."
"Yeah, I know." The rain intensified as he came off the ramp. Chris turned up the wipers. "Look, forget it. Send him anyway. My problem. I'll deal with it here."
"Is it something I need to worry about?"
"No, you did the right thing. It's fine. I'll be in touch." He cut the connection and redialed.
"Yeah, this is Bryant."
"Mike, it's Chris. We've got..."
"Just a man. You in yet?"
"On the way. Listen, Mike..."
"How about lending me some of that old emerging markets background you don't like to talk about these days, huh? You wouldn't fucking believe what happened in Harbin this morning."
"Mike."
"You remember that thing we were putting together with the guys in EM? The transport net sell-off?"
Chris gave up and searched his memory. The northeastern end of the former People's Republic of China wasn't his sphere of interest. Outside the tendencies of ethnic Chinese, where Tarimpendi was concerned, he didn't pay the area much attention. And his dealings with Sean's emerging markets division had been minimal so far. They were a hard enough bunch, but still pretty urbane by CI standards. Still, listening to Mike's tale of woe might help take the sting out of the minor fuck-up he had to report. So think. He recalled a late-night wine-bar bitching session a week back. Mike and some elegant Chinese woman from Sean EM. Crossover with an old CI account, guerrilla figures from the last decade now snugly installed as political leaders. Privatization schematics and character assassination of the major players, who could be trusted farther than they could be thrown. Macho stuff. The wine had been crap.
"Chris?"
"Yeah, yeah." He groped after a name. "The Tseng thing, right?"
"Right."
It was hard to tell if Bryant was angry or amused.
"Had it all lined up and ready to roll. Now some shithead civil servant has taken out, get this, a fucking injunction to prevent the sell-off. They're claiming it's unlawful under the 37 Constitution."
"Well, is it?"
"How the fuck would I know? I'm not EM, am I? Irene Land's team handled the legal stuff."
"Well, can't you, I don't know, pass a law or something? Change the current law? It's not like this is conflict, as such. You are the government out there." Mike sighed audibly.
"Yeah, I know. Fucking politics. Give me a Kalashnikov and a dickhead to fire it at any day. So, what's up?"
"What?"
"You sounded worried."
"Ah, yeah, just a glitch. Barranco's down to arrive in London on the 18th.
"The 18th? Oh, fuck, Chris, that's 2 days after Echevarria."
"I know."
"Couldn't you have..."
"Yeah, my fault, I know. I gave Lopez carte blanche to get him here, ASAP, no other parameters."
"Carte blanche?"
He could hear Mike grinning.
"Who's she?" "Yeah, all right, I don't suppose it matters much. We'd better just make sure they don't bang into each other in the corridor."
"Or at the North Memorial. I was thinking..." Impact. The meaty crunch of metal on metal. The Saab jolted hard left and started to skid from the back. His foot slipped on the accelerator, and he felt the treacherous slither as the wheels spun in water.
"Fuck!" "Now what?" Bryant threw a yawn.
He fought the skid, shedding speed as fast as he dared, eyes ripping across the mirrors searching for the other car, teeth gritted.
"Where are you, motherfucker?"
"Chris, you okay?" Another crunch from the rear. He wasn't yet fully out of the skid, and it sent him slithering again. He hauled on the wheel.
"Motherfucker!"
"Chris!" By now Mike had gotten it. His voice came through urgent.
"What's happening out there?"
"I'm..." Impact, again. He thought the Saab might spin clear around this time. Fighting it, he caught a glimpse of the other vehicle as it pulled clear. Primer grey, looked like an old Mitsubishi from what he could see of the lines, but with the amount of custom-built armouring it was hard to tell. No Namer? It was coming back, and the skid... He made the decision too fast for it to register until afterward. As the other car leapt forward, he jerked the wheel back the way he'd hauled it and opened up the skid. His guts sloshed. The no-namer struck, but Chris had read the maneuver correctly. With the spin on the Saab, his attacker's impact was a barely felt jab in a direction he was already sliding. The Saab spun about. For a heartbeat, they were parallel, facing each other. He saw a pale face staring through the windshield of the other car, then it was gone, past him southward as he braked the Saab to a wagging halt, pointed north. Rain drummed down on the roof. He felt his pulse catch up.
"Chris!"
"I'm fine." He slammed the car into gear and cut a sharp U-turn, peering through the sluicing water across his windshield. Up ahead he spotted brake lights.
"Some motherfucker is about to have his chassis squeezed." "You're fighting a challenge?"
"Looks like it." He took the Saab up through the gears, pushing each one as hard as he dared in the rain. The brake lights ahead of him went out, and he had to work to spot the outlines of the other car.
"Guy just landed on me, Mike. No Namer and no warning."
He frowned. And no proximity alarm.
"Chris, call driver control." Bryant sounded worried. "You don't have to drive this, if he hasn't filed. He's in breach of..."
Yeah, be with you in a minute."
The car was swelling in his forward view, moving, but throttled back, waiting for him.
"Come on, you fucker, let's see what you've got."
The grey car braked suddenly, trying to get behind him. He matched the manoeuvre and slewed into the vehicle's side. Metal screeched and tore. His wing mirror went, ripped free and bouncing away in their wake like a grenade. He looked across and made eye contact through windows streaming with rain. He saw the other driver flinch. The side-to-side clinch came apart. The no-namer picked up escape speed. Chris grinned savagely. Rattled. He went after him. His own shock was ebbing now, pulse coming down, brain working. Time to kill this piece of shit. Bryant seemed to have rung off, and the only sound was the roar of the engine and the hammering rain. The other car held him off. Neither driver could afford to go flat to the floor in a rain duel, and the no-namer was cool enough to know it. Chris stopped trying to close the gap and thought about the road ahead.
"This is driver control."
He glanced down at the radio in surprise.
"Yeah? Driver clearance 260B354R Faulkner C. You are engaged in an unauthorized duel."
"Hardly my choice, driver control."
"You are required to disengage immediately."
"No fucking way. This piece of shit is going down."
A pause. Chris could swear he heard a throat being cleared.
"I repeat, you are required to disengage and..."
"Have you tried telling that to our little primer-painted friend?"
Another pause. The gap was less than 10 meters. Chris upped his velocity, higher than he could afford on the rain-slick road. He felt a tiny bubble of fear rising in his chest with the knowledge.
"Your opponent does not respond to radio address."
"Yeah, well, I'll just go talk to him."
"You are required immediately to..."
He flattened the accelerator momentarily and clouted the no-namer across the driver's side rear wing. Driver control whittered from the speaker as the Saab slipped, and he dropped speed, fighting the urge to brake hard. The no-namer was trying to slow down. He drifted across and blocked the move. Another clank as they jammed together nose to tail. The other car flailed spray off the road as it tried to pull away and lost purchase in the wet. Chris felt his upper lip peel back from his teeth. He pulled fractionally left, shivery with the lack of firm control he had over the Saab, and accelerated again.
Good night, motherfucker.
He hit at an angle, and the skid kicked off in both cars. He felt the Saab start to skate from the front, saw the other car doing the same from the rear in graceful mirror image. Fragments of control left him, like sand through his fingers. He made a noise behind his teeth and fed all he had to the engine, hard and fast, and raking uncontrolled across the no-namer's sideways skating rear fender. Enough to push the whole thing beyond any hope of redemption for either of them. The nose-to-tail clinch came apart like a stick broken across a knee. It was like cutting a cable. Loss of control, seeming weightlessness, something approaching calm as the Saab spun out. For a timeless moment it was almost quiet. Even the snarl of the frustrated engine seemed to fade. Then he felt a side-swiping impact, as the two cars glanced off each other in drunken ballet. The Saab lurched. Time unlocked again. He was on the brakes. His hands were a blur on the wheel, hopelessly late behind the uncontrolled motion of the vehicle. The rain took over. In the windshield it seemed to curtain back momentarily to show him the embankment coming up fast. Deep breath. The Saab hit. The force of the impact lifted the car up on two wheels. It hung there for a moment. He had time to see the grass on the bank flattened against the passenger side window, then fell back to the asphalt, hard. The landing snapped his teeth together and clipped a chunk out of his tongue. For what seemed a very long time he sat in the stilled car, arms on the wheel, head down, tasting the blood in his mouth. The steady drumming of rain on the roof. He lifted his head and peered out across the highway. 50 meters off, in the slashing grey, he spotted the other car jammed against the crash barrier. There was steam pouring out of the crumpled hood. He grunted and sucked at the damage to his tongue. One hand crept out, more or less automatically, knocked on the hazard lights, killed the Saab's engine, which, I fucking love you, Carla, had not cut out. He opened the glove compartment and found the Nemex, checked the load and snapped the slide. Right. He cracked the door and climbed out into the rain. It drenched him before he'd gone half the distance to the other car, plastered his shirt to transparency on his body, turned his trousers sodden, and filled his Argentine leather shoes. He had to blink the stuff out of his eyes, rake his hair back from his face to peer into the wrecked car. It looked as if the other driver was trapped in his seat, struggling to free himself. Oddly, the expected victory surge didn't come. Maybe it was the rain that dampened the savagery, maybe a rapidly assimilating picture of angles that didn't fit. No proximity alarm. No filed challenge. He stared at the side of the primer-painted vehicle. There was no driver number anywhere on the body. No point. He circled the wreck warily, Nemex held low in both hands as Mike had shown him. He blinked rain out of his eyes. The other driver had the door open, but it looked as if the whole engine compartment had shifted backward with the impact, and the steering column had him pinned back in the seat. He was young, not out of his teens by the look of it. The unhealthy pallor of his skin suggested the zones. Chris stared at him, Nemex down.
"What the fuck did you think you were doing back there?"
The kid's face twisted.
"Hey, fuck you!"
"Yeah?" The anger came gushing up, the memory of the attack suddenly there. He sniffed the air and caught the scent of gasoline under the rain. "You got a cracked fuel feed there, son. You want me to fucking light it, you little shit?" The bravado crumpled. Fear smeared the kid's eyes wide. Chris felt a sudden flush of shame. This was some carjacker barely out of diapers. Some joyrider who just happened to jack an unnumbered crash wagon. Some joyrider who just happened to be cruising a motorway ramp an hour out of town, who decided to take on an obvious corporate custom job whose proximity alarm just happened to fail? Yeah, right. Chris wiped rain from his face and tried to think through the adrenaline come-down and the drenching he was getting. "Who sent you?" The kid set his mouth in a sullen line. Chris lost his temper again. He took a step closer and ground the muzzle of the Nemex into the boy's temple.
"I'm not fucking about here,"
he yelled. "You tell me who you're Sicario for. I might call the cutters for you. Otherwise I'm going to splash your fucking head all over the upholstery." He jabbed hard with the gun, and the kid yelped. "Now who sent you?"
"They told me."
"Never mind what they told you." Another muzzle jab. It drew blood. "I need a name, son, or you're going to die. Right here, right now." The kid broke. A long shudder and suddenly leaking tears. Chris eased the pressure on the gun.
"A name. I'm listening."
"They call him Factional, but..."
"Factional? He a zoner? A gangwit?" He jabbed the gun again, more gently.
"Come on."
The kid started to cry out loud.
"He ran the whole estate, man. He's going to..."
"Which estate?"
"Mandela. The Craigs."
"Southside. It was a start." "Okay, now you're going to tell me..."
"Stand away from the vehicle." The sky filled with a metal voice. "You are not authorized on this stretch. Stand away."
The driver-control helicopter swung down from the embankment where the Saab had wound up and danced crabwise across the air to the median 10 meters up. Chris sighed and lifted his hands. Nemex held ostentatiously by the barrel.
"Stand aside and place your weapon on the ground."
The kid was looking confused, not sure if he was off the hook yet. He couldn't move enough to wipe the tears off his face, but there was an ugly confidence already surfacing in his eyes. Well, whoever said a good driver had to be smart as well.
"I'll be talking to you later," Chris snapped,
wondering how the hell he was going to ensure it happened. Estate gang lords had a nasty habit of disappearing their sicarios when they became a liability, and he didn't have much faith in the regular police's ability to keep undervalued zone criminals alive in custody. He'd have to call a contractor, get private security onto the cutting crew, and trace the kid to whatever charity clean-up shop they dumped him at, then talk to Troy Morris about the Southside gangs. He backed off half a dozen steps, bent and placed the Nemex on the ground, then straightened up and spread his arms at the helicopter.
"Return to your vehicle and await instructions."
He went, arms still raised, just in case. He was about halfway back when the Gatlings cut loose. The sound of whining, whirling steel and the shattering roar of the multiple barrels unloading. He hit the asphalt face down a pair of seconds before the realization hit him that they were not firing at him, could not be, because he was still alive. He lifted his head a cautious fraction, craned it to look back. The helicopter had sunk almost to asphalt level and swung around nose to nose with the wrecked car. Later he guessed the maneuver was intended to keep him out of the field of fire. The zone kid must have gotten it head on. The full fury of the Gatling hail as it tore through the windshield and everything behind it. The tank went up with a dull crump. Chris clamped his hands over his head, face to the road. An insanely calm part of him knew there wouldn't be much shrapnel off a vehicle that armored, but you always had glass. He heard some of it hiss past. The Gatlings shut off. In their place there was a greedy crackling as the fire took hold in the wreck. The departing throb of the helicopter. He lifted his head again, just in time to see it disappear over the embankment the way it had come. Flames curled from the strafed car, bright and cheery through the rain. Thinking about getting up, he heard a sudden ripple of explosions and flattened himself to the asphalt again. Slugs in the abandoned Nemex, he guessed, cooked to ignition point by the backwash of heat from the fire. He stayed down. The fucking Nemex. He found himself grinning. Louise will be pleased. Finally he judged it safe and picked himself up. He lifted his arms wide and stared down at himself. His shirt was sodden and grimed from contact with the road, but there was no blood that he could find. No pain but the faint sting of abrasions on his palms and a couple of numb spots on hip and knee. He couldn't tell if he'd done any serious damage to the suit trousers, but he guessed they were as soiled as the shirt. In the wreck, the rain was already beating out the flames. Chapter 27. The inquest was held, in stark corporate style, around a huge oval table in Notley's penthouse conference room. Sean had given the public sector 3 days, overly generous in my opinion, was Hewitt's comment, and now it was smackdown time. The conference room was an apt arena. The walls were full of violent commissioned art from the new brutalist school, solid blocks of primary colour dumped amid vague scattered scrawls that might have been writing or crowds of tiny people. Obvious video scan units gleamed beadily from the ceiling, but there was a standard 40-second delay on the recording system, and 2 Sean lawyers sat in to make sure anything potentially awkward got stopped before it was halfway said. In the run-up, Chris and Mike both got repeated briefings from the legal team until they were coached almost to a line. Louise Hewitt and Philip Hamilton joined Notley to form an operational quorum, though everybody on the corporate side of the table knew no serious decisions would be taken at this particular meeting. This was noise-making. Sean was coiled up like a rattlesnake, signalling loud offence. Any genuine strike would come later when no one was around to take notes. Across the table from Chris sat the crew of the helicopter and the driver control duty officer from the day of the duel. They were recognizable by their suits. You could have bought any 3 of the outfits they wore for the price of Jack Notley's shoes. Between Notley and the duty officer sat the Assistant Commissioner of Traffic Enforcement and the District Police Superintendent for London South 9. Holographically present at the opposite end of the table, the current Minister for Transport floated like an apologetic ghost.
"What remains most disturbing about this matter," said Notley, as the recriminations began to run down, "is not the type of response elicited from driver control, but the rapidity of that response, or shall I say the lack of rapidity."
The duty officer flinched, but stoically. He'd already had a pretty rough ride and was learning not to react. Any attempt at defence from the public sector players around the table had led to a shredding at the hands of the Sean partners. Hewitt led, wet razor swift and slicing. Hamilton provided soft-spoken, insolent counterpoint, and Notley came in behind, picking up the points and swinging the mace of Sean's corporate clout. There wasn't a person in the room, the minister included, whose job was secure if Notley decided the time had come to slop the coffee cup hard enough. The Assistant Commissioner nobly essayed a rescue. She'd been working salvage throughout the meeting.
"I think we're agreed that the response team would have been scrambled earlier if Mr. Bryant's original emergency call had been supported by Mr. Faulkner's responses to radio communication. The recording shows an angry executive acting unwisely," said Louise Hewitt, with a thin smile in Chris's direction. "I think we can all understand how Chris Faulkner felt, but that does not mean he reacted correctly. He was, shall we say, overawed. As duty officer with the advantage of a detached view, it was your job to realize that, and react accordingly."
The duty officer met her gaze bravely.
"Yes, I appreciate that. I should not have allowed an executive to override my professional instincts. I shall not let it happen again."
"Good." Hewitt nodded and scribbled on her display pad.
"That's noted and appreciated. Superintendent Lahiri, can we go back to the matter of the criminal who, according to Chris Faulkner's testimony, was responsible for hiring the sicario?"
The superintendent nodded. He was a wiry, tough-looking man in his 50s, an obvious holdover from the autonomous days. He had kept quiet for most of the proceedings and watched the interplay with shrewd attention. When he spoke, it was with the precision of a man who measured and cut his sentences before uttering them.
"Khalid Iorescu, yes. He has been arrested."
"Has he confessed?"
Lahiri frowned.
"He is a career criminal, Miss Hewitt. Simply arresting him has caused serious injury to 3 of my men. We are unlikely to extract a confession."
"Can't we put pressure on his family?"
"Not without further large-scale incursions into the South Side, and that I would not recommend. The populace is already stirred up more than we'd like. And Iorescu has unchallenged control of the Mandela estate, as well as agreements with the gang lords in neighbouring areas. His immediate family are doubtless already well hidden and protected. And his lawyers are now attempting to have him released under the Citizens' Charter."
Lahiri spread his hands.
"I can have him charged with resisting arrest, maybe with 1 or 2 outstanding drug offences, but beyond that I am not hopeful. Even within that framework, I am not hopeful that we can secure a conviction.
Khalid Irescu is a well-connected man.
Bryant snorted.
He's a fucking gangwit, is what he is.
Notley cut him a sharp look.
The name, Superintendent. It's what, Hungarian?
Romanian. That is, his father was a Romanian immigrant. His mother is Moroccan.
Can we threaten him with expulsion?
Notley has shifted focus. The question was addressed to the minister.
The Hollow shook its head regretfully.
No, I've examined the files. Both parents were naturalized. He is, in technical terms, as English as you or I.
Notley rolled his eyes. Hamilton made a sleepy gesture.
Just a thought. The boy who actually stole the car. He had family?
Yes.
Lahiri looked down at his notes, did not look up again while he spoke.
The Goodwins. Mother and father, two brothers and a sister. They've been evicted, as per policy.
Yes, good.
Hamilton reached for his glass of water and sipped at it.
I don't suppose there's any chance that this Iorescu will be seen to associate with them, offer them succor, so to speak. Solidarity from the estate patriarch, the, big man ethos?
Lahiri shook his head.
It doesn't work like that, sir, outside the movies. Iorescu is a successful criminal. He knows the ropes both within and without the zones. If anything, he will distance himself from the whole affair. In fact,
a hesitant look at Chris,
I'm afraid there really is nothing substantial to make the connection in the first place.
Chris held down his temper. They'd been around this block before.
I told you what I heard, Superintendent. I didn't imagine it. The boy named the estate and Iorescu. Yes, I understand that, sir, but you must see that this in itself is not evidence. No, please.
He raised a hand. Hear me out.
In gang culture, status is accorded by association. The boy may have believed that by naming a major player as his sponsor, he could protect himself.
Fascinating, murmured Hamilton. Almost talismanic, isn't it? Almost tribal.
Lahiri's lip almost curled. Moreover, the tag factional is close to generic. In the South Side zones alone, you have gang leaders styling themselves Faction Red, Sataz Faction, Factual, Factual Base.
The list goes on. Gang culture is mimetic, imaginative only within very limited given parameters.
To my ears, what you heard has the ring of stock response.
Chris shook his head.
Do you have something fresh to add, Chris?
Louise Hewitt asked sweetly.
Silence. Some shuffling from the duty officer. The minister's Hollow checked its watch surreptitiously.
Jack Notley uncapped an antique fountain pen with a loud snap.
"Well, then," he said briskly, "if we can proceed to recommendations."
"Motherfucking whitewash bullshit!"
Chris wasn't sure if Mike's place was secure or not. Pre-Vasvik, he'd never even have given it consideration. Now he just didn't care. The long squeeze of keeping to the shorn script had festered in him for too long.
Fucking lies and shit-mouthed expediency from end to motherfucking end.
You think so?
Mike leaned across the kitchen table with Rioja and topped up his glass. Behind the gesture he raised his brows at Suki, who shrugged and went on sculpting roses into the carrot sections on her cutting board. Chris missed it.
Of course it was. Stock response, my fucking ass. That kid was hired by Iorescu to grease me, and someone hired Iorescu to get it done. Someone with money.
Mike was silent. Chris gestured with his wineglass.
You heard what Lahiri said. Iorescu's connected, in the zones and out. This is corporate, Mike. This came down from on high.
Chris, you realize how paranoid you sound?
I was there, Mike. They blew that kid away to stop him talking.
Bryant frowned and leaned back in his chair.
The report says he went for a weapon.
Oh, Mike, he was pinned in the fucking wreckage.
Chris caught Suki's glance at the ceiling. She'd only put Ariana to bed an hour ago. He lowered his voice.
Sorry, Suki. I'm just upset. We're all upset, Chris.
Mike got up and prowled the kitchen.
Obviously. I mean, yeah, we can't have just anybody on the roads raging without authorization. The whole damn system will collapse.
That's what I'm telling you, Mike. This wasn't just anybody. This was allowed to happen. They didn't scramble the heli until they knew I'd driven that little shit off the road. They did what they were told, and they let it happen. I mean, why do you think no one got sacked? The heli crew, the duty officer.
Come on, they all got reprimands. It'll go...
Reprimands?
On their file.
Christ, the duty officer got 3 months suspension without pay. Yeah, and did you see how happy he was with that? He'll be taken care of, Mike.
I think, Bryant said somberly, that he was happy because he still has a job to go back to. Notley could easily have kicked him into touch.
Exactly. So why didn't he? Someone's got dual control here, Mike, and you know it. Someone's cranking Notley's cable.
This time Mike Bryant laughed out loud.
Suki frowned at him. Michael, that's not very nice. Chris is upset.
Okay, I'm sorry. It's just the thought of someone cranking the cables of Jack Notley. I mean, come on, Chris. You know the man.
Suki, you've met him. He's not exactly malleable.
They both looked at Chris. He sighed.
All right, maybe not Notley. Maybe not that high up. Maybe Hewitt. She's never liked me. Or listen, maybe it's as simple as Nick Makin looking for payback on that punch I landed.
This time he caught the exchange of glances between husband and wife.
All right, I know. But I'm not paranoid, Mike. Someone tampered with my proximity alarm.
The report said it was the rain, Chris. You saw that crack.
Bryant turned to include Suki.
The mechanics at driver control found a leak in the access paneling on Chris's security masterboard. It shorted out the whole alarm system.
Oh, bullshit, Mike. Carla checks those panels every...
He gestured, suddenly unnerved by his lack of certainty.
I don't know, every week at least she would have spotted it.
He didn't tell them that he'd had a screaming argument with Carla when the preliminary results of the Shawn investigation came in, that he'd jumped automatically toward blame and belief in what Mike obviously still believed, that Carla had missed the leak. It had taken her more than an hour to talk him down.
I know what I'm fucking doing, she told him grimly, when the fight had burned itself out. If there was a crack in that paneling, someone fucking put it there, and not that long ago.
Carla knows what she's doing, he said, staring into his wine glass.
Nobody answered him. The silence started to creak under its own weight. Chris stared at the tabletop, trying to think of something to say that wouldn't sound deranged.
You really believe this, don't you, Chris?
Said Suki.
It didn't come out as supportive as she was obviously trying to be.
Chris shook his head.
I don't know what I believe. Look, Mike, is it possible this is something to do with a name contract? Somebody outside Shawn, I mean? Maybe I was tagged getting in and out of Panama.
Bryant gestured.
You said you were careful.
I was. But something is going down, Mike. I can feel it.
Sure, something's going down. You're about to sell out your colleagues for a public sector sinecure with the Bleeding Heart UN Leech Gang. That's what's going down, Chris. And maybe someone knows that. The paranoia made icy tracks down his spine.
Okay.
Mike sat down again. He steepled his fingers on the table.
Tell you what, we'll look into it. Unofficially, I mean. I'll talk to Troy, get him to ask around. He's got friends in the Southside zones. We'll see what he turns up. Meantime, we've got other stuff to worry about. Echevarria.
Chris groaned.
Don't remind me.
Flies in Tuesday, Chris, and we've got Barranco arriving right behind him, not even 2 full days between.
The week from hell.
Mike grinned.
That's right. So tonight, let's just forget about the whole fucking thing and get wrecked. What time you reckon Carla'll be here?
She said before 8.
Chris glanced at his watch.
Maybe she got held up at the checkpoints.
Want to call her?
No, it's... He realized how it looked. Yeah, maybe I should.
Carla was running an hour late, for no reason she felt like offering. Chris bit back his annoyance.
Well, when... He began thinly. Oh, Chris, just start without me. I'm sure you're already having fun.
He looked around at Mike and Suki, glad he'd used the cell and not the videophone. Bryant was leaning against his wife and nuzzling at her ear through the immaculate auburn mane. She laughed, flinched away, then reached around to grab the ends of his loosened tie and pull him close. The little scene radiated groomed marital content, a synthetic blend of sex and wealth and domesticity straight out of a screen ad. He thought suddenly of a kitchen in Highgate, and an unforgivable wish surged up in him.
"Well, get here as soon as you can," he said, and hung up.
Mike looked up. "She okay?"
"Yeah, be here in about an hour. Some kind of crisis with the lubricant system."
He smiled weakly.
"Suppose I should be glad she's that obsessive."
"Shit, yeah. If Suki was my mechanic, I'd never let her out of the fucking garage. Ow!"
"Bastard."
He tried to join in with the laughter, but his heart wasn't in it.
"Chris, you know the horse joke?"
Bryant poured more wine.
"Guy goes into a bar and sees a horse standing there. So he goes up to him and says, 'So, why the long face?'"
More laughter, filling up the beautiful kitchen like the smell of cooking he wasn't invited to share. He wished Liz would hurry up and... Carla. He wished Carla would hurry up and... And what? Come on, Chris. Finish that thought. It must have shown on his face. Mike came across and clapped him on the shoulder.
"Oh, Chris, come on, man. Honestly, I really don't think you should be worrying. I mean, in the end, you trashed the little fucker."
"He's smoked meat.
And let's face it, with the rep you've got, no one smarter than a fuckwit gang sprog is going to want to drive against you."
He raised his glass.
"You've got nothing to worry about, man."
Chapter 28. Midweek. Regime change was quiet. Cheap cocktails and genteel pole dancing brought in a scattering of suits from the local offices and recently paid zone workers who knew they'd never get in on a Friday or Saturday night. By 8:30 or 9 they were mostly leaving, the zone types headed home with their shallow finances drained, the suits going on to less genteel clubs, where you could get your hands on the dancers.
"I would have suggested somewhere else," Chris gestured at the center of the Iraq room, where a veiled woman naked from the neck down flexed around a newly installed silver pole to the unwinding cadences of Cairo scene.
The spectators sat at pipe tables or stood about in small knots, staring.
"I didn't realize."
Liz Linshaw laughed and sipped at the pipe between them. She plumed whiskey-scented smoke in the dancer's direction.
"You don't approve?"
He spread his hands helplessly. "Well, it's not just what I had in mind when I, you know, called you."
"Chris."
She leaned closer to beat the music, grinning.
"You really don't have to work so hard at not looking at her. I already know you're an honorable man. Way past honorable, in fact."
The dancer bellied up to the pole, slid it up and down between her breasts. Chris took a deep interest in the low, hammered copper table the pipe stood on. Liz Linshaw laughed again.
"Look."
She leaned across to place one hand gently against his cheek and pushed his head back toward the performance. He fought down a jagged impulse to grab the hand and twist it away.
"I mean, look. Really look at her. Let's get this over with. She's sexy, isn't she? Young. No, don't look away. It's a great body, worked out, and worked on, obviously, unless someone invented anti-gravity fields recently. Yeah, if I were a man, she'd do it for me. She'd make me... Chris! Hey, Chris, you're blushing!"
"No, I'm..."
"You are. I can feel it. Your face is hot."
She laughed again, delightedly.
"Chris, you really are in trouble. You're a grown man, you've got a dozen kills under your belt, and you can't look at soft porn without flushing like a teenager. I mean, what do you and Carla Nyquist do in the bedroom?"
She must have seen the change in his face. Before he could move, she reached out and touched his arm.
"Sorry, Chris, I'm sorry. That was bitchy."
This time he did take hold of her hand. He pushed it back across the table and sat looking at her in silence.
"Chris, I said I'm sorry."
They were saved by the pipe waitress. She sauntered across, lifted the cage, and cast a practiced eye over the glowing embers of tobacco in the pan. She glanced at Chris.
"Bring you another."
He hadn't smoked much of the first. It was just the price of sitting there while he waited for Liz Linshaw. He shrugged.
"No, I think we're pretty much done here."
The waitress left. He met Liz Linshaw's gaze and held it.
Chris.
Reason I asked you here, Liz. You got friends in driver control, right? She looked away, then back.
Yes. Yes, I have.
Inside sources? People who can get information for you?
Is this really why you called me, Chris?
Yes. You have sources, right? A shrug.
I'm a journalist.
There's something I need to know. I need to find out if...
Whoa, Chris. She gave him a hard little smile. Slow down. Now, I may have just gone over the line a little with that bitchy crack about your wife, but that doesn't mean you own a part of me. Why the fuck would I put pressure on one of my hard-won sources for you? What's in it for me?
You're writing another book, right? She nodded. So this is a whole chapter, if you're lucky. He hesitated at the edge, looking for something to fill the gap that had suddenly opened up between them. You heard I was up against a no-namer last week?
Yes, inconclusive, I heard. Driver control had to come in and mediate.
She smiled a little more warmly this time.
I'm sorry, Chris. I like you, but I don't shadow you through the net on a day-to-day basis. There was something about a software failure. The challenge didn't register in the system or something.
Yeah, that's the official line. One eyebrow arched. He thought there was a little mockery in it.
And the unofficial line?
The no-namer was never registered in the first place. Some zone kid jacked a battle wagon and tried to take me down in the rain. No challenge issued. And driver control didn't mediate. They turned up with an enforcement copter after I drove the kid off the road, and they fed him a couple of cans of Gatling shells for breakfast. He saw with some satisfaction the way the shock went through her, how her carefully constructed cool fractured open. Her voice, when it came, was almost a whisper.
They killed him?
Pretty conclusively, yeah.
But they haven't traced the car?
Chris nodded. To an unemployed data systems consultant. He reported it stolen from outside his house in Harleston about an hour after the duel.
He must have known before that.
Not necessarily. He hadn't driven it for a while, apparently. Couldn't afford to renew the license this quarter.
Do you believe that?
Journalistic interest kindling. From the look of him in the interview tape, he'd be hard-pressed to afford a full tank of fuel, let alone a license to use it, so yes, I do. But in the end it doesn't matter. Whoever set this up is a long way up the chain from either him or the kid who nicked the car, and whoever set this up also has their claws into driver control.
All right, I'll buy that. What else do you have?
That's a lot. He wasn't about to get into the Mandela estate connection. Troy Morris was already running down rumours across the South Side, asking softly after Robbie Goodwin's displaced family, trying to find a safe approach to Khalid Iarescu's underworld machine. The last thing he'd need was a high-profile journalist crashing the zones and stirring things up. Liz Linshaw was most use where she already was, highly placed in the world of competition driving, reeking of cachet and connection. She smiled, as if she could read his thoughts.
No, there's more. You just don't feel like telling me right now.
She shrugged.
It's okay, I can live with that. Sure, I'll talk to some people I know. Shouldn't take much leverage to see if something's being covered up. I can take it from there.
She picked up the pipe and drew on it. Inside the cage, the last of the embers flared.
You understand this doesn't come for free. I do it, and you'll owe me, Chris. Big time.
Like I said, it'll make a chapter of...
No.
She shook her head and her hair fell across her face. It made him want to clear it away with one hand.
That's not what I mean.
So what do you mean? The corner of her mouth quirked and she looked away.
You know what I mean, Chris.
That sat between them for a while, smouldering out like the pipe. Listen, he said.
I know, Chris, I know. In fact, I've seen it all before. You've got some stuff you've got to work through. Don't worry about it, and don't flatter yourself. I'm not short of male company, believe me.
You seen Mike again? It was out before he could stop himself.
She raked fingers into her own hair and grinned up at the corner of the room.
"That really is none of your business, Chris."
"I'm not like him, Liz."
"No, you're not."
"I don't see the women around me as product." The images from the porn segment glowed in his head. Studded leather parting buttocks, encircling breasts impossibly full. Fully clothed, the Liz Linshaw sitting opposite him shrugged.
"Mike Bryant knows what he wants, and he takes it, and then he looks after it as best he can. I don't think his morality stretches much farther than that, but he does at least know what he wants."
Her eyes flickered up to meet his. She was still smiling. "Listen, Liz, that night, He swallowed. "I'm having some problems with my marriage, but that doesn't mean I..."
"Chris."
He'd never in his life been interrupted so gently.
"I don't care. I want to fuck you, not replace your wife. But I'll tell you something for nothing. You came home with me that night, and you grabbed hold of the merchandise when it was on display. Whatever's going on in your relationship with Carla, you might as well have fucked me then. You've got the same guilt and the same hard-on for me. The fact you didn't do it is a technicality."
"You..." She waved it off, getting up, shouldering her way into her jacket.
"I'll get back to you about driver control. But the next time you get a bed for the night at my place, you'll work your passage."
In the end, the pipe waitress came and told him he'd have to order something else if he wanted to sit there any longer. Chapter 29. Lopez routed Barranco's flight plan through Atlanta and Montreal before a dawn arrival at Reagan International, New York, where a Shawn jet would pick the two of them up under paperwork that identified them as economic advisers for the Paraná Emergency Council. Lopez spoke Brazilian Portuguese almost as well as his native Spanish, and Barranco, like most political figures in Latin America these days, had enough to get by. Lopez was betting security at Reagan International would neither know the difference nor care. Apparently, his assessment was on the nail. The Shawn jet lifted without incident and touched down in London just after lunch. Chris rode the courtesy copter out to meet it.
"Señor Barranco!"
He had a shout above the racket of the rotors and the unseasonally cold wind that came buffeting across the asphalt of the private carrier's terminal. His grin felt sandblasted onto his face. Armed security stood around in suits, jackets whipping up constantly to reveal their shoulder holsters.
"Welcome to England! How was your flight?"
Barranco grimaced. He looked good in the smart, casual, mobile consultant wardrobe Lopez had disguised him with, but above the knit wool jacket his face was smeared with jet lag.
"Which flight do you mean? I seem to have been in transit for a week, and now a helicopter." "Believe me, Señor Barranco, you wouldn't want to drive through this part of London. Is Joaquin Lopez with you?"
Barranco jerked a thumb back at the Shawn jet.
"He's coming."
Lopez appeared in the hatch and clambered down, followed by two more men with baggage. He grinned and waved at Chris. No sign of the weariness you could see on Barranco. Beneath his mob